All right, Chit Shows, if you were someone who constantly finds yourself giving, giving, and then giving more to the point where you are completely burnt out, listen up. I am teaming up with the Boundaries Queen herself, Barb Nangle, to host a transformative workshop called Stop Overgiving, Repair Your Life from the Inside Out. It's happening on Wednesday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and this workshop is for anyone who is trapped in people-pleasing patterns, exhausted from sacrificing your needs on behalf of others, for anyone whose inability to set boundaries is causing you to neglect yourself, saying yes when you really want to say no because you think saying no makes you a bad person. In this workshop, Barb is going to teach you how to set clear, authentic boundaries, giving you real tools you can start using immediately. She will provide you with tips and scripts on what to say and how to say it, as well as what to do when people push back against your boundaries. Plus, there will be plenty of time for you to get answers on your personal questions directly from a boundaries expert. So if you are ready to break out of this people-pleasing prison you're trapped in, start living for yourself, well, how about you head to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops to get your damn spot. I'm also running a special right now. If you join the Shit Show community between now and November 1st, you will get access to this workshop for free. So with limited capacity, make sure you get your ticket now before it's gone. So either go to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops or go to the show notes and DM the Join Shit Show. Trust me, this is a workshop you don't want to miss. When we strive to become better than we are, everything around us becomes better too. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. What you're holding on to? Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. I don't know if I've shared this yet on the podcast. I'm a new mom to two new kittens, Tucker and Cheeto, or as I've been calling them, Tucky Butt and Cheeto Boy. My song from the mess. Tucky Butt and Cheeto Boy and Tucky Butt and Cheeto Boy. They are not brothers, but they are a bonded pair, and they are total psychopaths, total psychos. So for those of you who don't know, I had to put my cat down. Kiki, the love of my life, on September 11th, she was my everything. And the week leading up to me putting her down was just like the most painful week of my entire life. It was horrendous. And I've never experienced loss at that level. And I felt some relief after I put her down. And then I feel like I went kind of numb. And it was through getting these two kitties, I got them, I guess it's been a little over 2 weeks now. And when I brought them home, boy, that brought up all of my grief for Kiki. And I just was like hysterically crying. And I still miss her so much. Oh, these new guys are growing on me, you know, but it's just not the same. Sorry, I didn't think I was gonna cry, but yeah, they're so sweet and they're so loving, but they're not my Kiki, and I just miss her so much. So oh, get it together. Lordy lord. So yeah, Tucky Butt and Cheeto Boy. My two little new psychopaths. Boy, are they're super cute. And so this is where we talk about what to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up a whole hell of a lot more than you initially thought it did, and you realize that you actually have complex trauma and you have complex PTSD that you didn't know was there. This is where we talk about serious shit, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. And on that note, folks, I had an interview all lined up and ready to go for you guys today until I realized that it was a horrible idea. It was a horrible idea to have this interview come out for today. Just not the right timing, given that it would be the day after the election and I was interviewing two authors of a new book on how to recover from suicidal ideation. Yes, suicidal ideation. And tensions are high and people are stressed out and anxious, understandably. And, you know, obviously it's Tuesday night at 6 o'clock. I don't know what's going to happen, but regardless of what happens, I just didn't think that it probably was the right timing for us to have an episode about suicidal ideation, folks. What do you think? So I have gone back into the vault and picked out one of the fan faves, an oldie but a goodie, with a therapist named Alex Castro-Croy. I'm going to include the introduction from that episode because I share a kind of a funny dating story. I was just listening to it. So this was from, let's see here. This was from August 24th, 2022. And so with this being election day, I just want to share what I shared in the shit show community today. I put a video out just saying that it is so important to me that politics stays out of the community. And it's been really important to me to have politics stay out of this podcast. This country and this culture has become so divisive. And it's really important to me that that doesn't seep into the shit show community or into the podcast. What I think is so beautiful is that we are people coming together with so many different backgrounds and varied experiences and viewpoints and opinions, all connecting under the shared experience of trying to heal from our childhoods. And I think that that is something to be treasured. So this is all about connection, true, vulnerable, authentic connection, connecting with one another on a soul level. And politics has no place for that, in my opinion. So, tuck your butt and cheetah boy. Sorry, I won't do that anymore. Let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you needed to DM the Join Shit Show, because the shit show community was not around when this podcast was initially released. This is my online community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows. We have a variety of subgroups within the community, so you can find people that have your own unique experiences or struggles, whether that's shit show parenting or divorce and separation, a neurodivergent group, a narcissistic abuse group, a childhood sexual abuse group. We have an internal family systems group. We have a shit show dudes group. We have a whole hell of a bunch of groups that you can join. So I do just want to give a shout out to the newest members of the community. So thank you to these fine ass shit shows. Racy, Erica, Jason, Morgan, Julia, Rachel, Sarah, Carrie, David, another Sarah, Mary Parker, Amber, Jeff, Shelby, Krista, Alexis, Nikita, Jessica, and James. Thank you. How about the rest of y'all follow suit? See the link in the show notes. Damn the joint shit show, y'all. Just do it, okay? Next, give me a little follow on Insta and the TikTok at AdultTrollPod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. If you could leave a nice little comment review, it'd be much appreciated. Love you all. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Welcome back. I already said that. Hi. Hi, if you're new, I'm Andrea, and I'm a shit show. Clearly. Welcome. Buckle up. I'm sitting here right now, and directly across the room from me, what I see is a bottle of hand sanitizer. Now, if you're in the Patreon, you probably know about this bottle of hand sanitizer, but let me share with the rest of you. So I had a first date that was a last date, the first date that did not become a second date, and a gift that this gentleman walked into my home, and he had a bottle of, he said, I have a gift for you. And I was like, first I thought it was a bottle of lube. Like I really thought it was a bottle of lube. And then I realized that it was a bottle of hand sanitizer. It was like, we're talking like a contact solution sized bottle of hand sanitizer. I do not believe that
this individual that he stopped specifically to get this for me. Although that would be great. Like, I kind of wish that he did, but I really think I don't know. I think he just had it in his car or something and was like, oh, I'll just give this to her. How romantic, right? Yeah, it started off that way. It did not get any better. It only got worse. And the real icing was when he texted me like a week later. So let me just say this. Thank God I was not into this guy, because so we had a date on a Sunday and then I didn't hear from him until Friday. Thank God I wasn't into him, because I would have been a little stressed out. I didn't respond, which was appropriate given everything that had occurred. Got to join the Patreon if you want to hear those details, but it was appropriate for me to not respond. And so when I did not respond, the next day he sent me a text and he said, I guess I must be Brian number 3. How dare you? How dare you call yourself a Brian? You're not even a Ryan, okay? You don't get, what a diss to Brian number 1 and Brian number 2 for this bozo who gives hand sanitizer on a first date to refer to himself as Brian. No, sir. Moving it along. So today we are diving deep with a shit show like us, but also someone who helps shit shows like us. So we're joined by Alex Castro Croy. He's a therapist, a trauma therapist. He's based out of Denver. And this is a goodie. This is a goodie. And I say that about all, what if one time I'm just like, guys, this one coming up, this interview coming up just sucks ass. just listen to it until it gets to like the transitionary music, so I can at least get like the downloads. But like, this one's horrible, so don't even bother. I'll let you know if that ever is the case, okay? But today that's not the case. We're diving into a lot of different things. I feel like this is one that's like worthy of, maybe you want to have a pen and paper out. I shouldn't be saying this. This is like when somebody tells you that like a TV show is going to be really good, or a movie, and then it's never good because your expectations were set high. So let me rephrase. This interview is like so-so, okay? Like, this is just so-so. I don't know if you're going to be better. You're not going to be any worse off after listening to this. I'm not sure if you're going to be better. I mean, it's so-so, but keep listening. Keep listening to it and maybe have a pen and paper. One of the things that we're talking about is this process of inner alchemy. So about how our transformation, this recovery process that we're going through, is essentially, you know, an alchemical process of us turning our pain into gold, turning our trauma into gold. And I'm really feeling that. I'm really feeling that. And it's a message that I'm at least trying to convey to all y'all, that it's much more than just peeling. It's about thriving. And I truly believe that all of our pain serves such a great purpose. And it's hard to see that in the moment, but it always has been the case for me. I want to read you this quote that I found. I've been going on like an inner alchemy deep dive on the interwebs. And this one quote says, self-transformation means being responsible for our own stuff and not projecting it onto others. It does not matter what stage you are at in your self-transformation process, because all stages are necessary and you will be going over each stage many times in your life. What matters is that you are honest with yourself and you are trying to change, which many people unfortunately can't be bothered to do, and they continue to add to the madness in this world. So guess what? If you're listening to these words right now, you are trying to change. So give yourself a little pat, pat, pat on the back. Okay, let's move along to the interview. All right, y'all. What is my pleasure to introduce Alex Castro Croy to the podcast. How the hell are you doing today, sir?
I am doing great. I'm honored and humbled to be here with you. I absolutely love the content and how you are able to enrich the community with a lot of your gifts. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. That means a lot. You are, I don't know if the golden goose is the right term, but you know how rare you are. You are a therapist out there who knows what an adult child is and who's actually doing the damn work yourself.
Correct.
Do you have like no availability?
Well, actually, I actually stepped away from doing a lot of availability, but I do a lot more training, and a lot more intentional work with people who are ready to do the work. Does that make sense? So I run a men's alchemy group, a men's trauma group at my agency, with a lot of core concepts of trauma focus, CBT, DBT, Jungian depth concepts, which include a lot of the ACA content as well, inner child archetypal work, inner teenager, inner wounding. And so I use a lot of the Greek definition of trauma, which is wound. And that really opens, it destigmatizes the conversation and it opens up, it helps men open up, especially about their wounds and not look at it as a,
Weakness.
yes, weakness, psychopathology, sickness. It's like, oh, this is actually a cut that I got. Oh, you got a cut too? Let's talk about how we got cut and
Oh,
how
I
our
love
parents.
that.
And so they open up. And so I do a men's group every Saturday mornings at 8 in the morning. And then I'm starting a Spanish speaking group on Tuesday nights. And then my staff, I've trained my staff to do a females alchemy group. And they're going to start a Spanish female alchemy group. So we do trauma and addiction groups in Spanish and English with components of adult children with dysfunction, either adult children of alcoholics or adult children with dysfunctional families. So yeah.
Okay, well, I have a ton of questions there, but
Yes.
first I have to say this, and my audience is probably getting sick of me saying this. But like, why are there so many damn therapists out there who can't tell us that we're an adult child?
I think a lot of people don't understand, even though it does have the 12 step, a lot of people don't necessarily subscribe to 12 steps, higher power, but it's, I think if anything, it's a resource and a tool. I've had a lot of people who don't necessarily subscribe, but the higher power can be 80-year-old me.
Well, no, I just mean that like that are that the reason that we're fucked up is because of our childhood. Like, I just feel
Oh.
like so many of us go in therapy
Yeah.
and they never tell us what's actually wrong with us.
I think also it determines it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And when we look at different people's modalities, I think about solution-focused therapy. We're gonna deal with the here and now, a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. Let's look at the thought connected to the emotion. Where when we talk about adult children of ICA, adult children of dysfunctional families, we go into family systems. We go into unhealthy patterns of thinking, unhealthy patterns, early childhood schemas, early childhood templates that were passed on. And then there's a component of trauma too that requires a lot of work. And here's the other thing too, Andrea, that
Andrea, just so you know, I'll kill you if you call me Andrea.
Andrea, that a lot of times it's uncomfortable for a lot of people who haven't done their work to hold space for people who are ready to do
Absolutely.
their work. And so you cannot give what you don't have. And if I haven't dealt with my trauma, if I haven't dealt with my inner child work, how can I hold space for you to do your own?
Okay, so the last question on this, and I like to ask this too. So, what would be some good questions for some if they're interviewing a therapist? What are some good questions to ask to see if they're going to be able to? And when I say adult child, I don't mean like, 12-step based, but I mean, like the adult child syndrome.
Yeah, right.
What are some good questions that someone could ask a potential therapist to see if whether or not they're going to be a good fit?
When I used to interview for my therapist, I always asked them, are you aware of intergenerational trauma? Are you aware of how it impacts the inner child archetypal psychology? Obviously, and because that's the huge piece of ACA. And then number three, have you done your work? Do you do your work? Do you get counseling? Do you get consultation around your clients? That's a fair question, because if you do your therapy, that means you go get your oil changed. That means that you go get maintenance. Mm-hmm. If you do peer consultation, it means that you talk to other clinicians and therapists to pick their brain about something that you don't know. So that lets me know that you are open to growth and you are open to learning. And I am not responsible to teach you.
So what's something that you've reached out to another practitioner to pick their brain about?
I think for me, one of the key pieces that I've done is a lot with around sex addiction, polyamory. When I started doing work with people who are addicted to sex, I realized I wasn't well-versed with that. And so especially with polyamory, people who are in ethical non-monogamy, I realized this is a whole new area that I don't know. And so I did peer consultation with that to see like, hey, you work with people who have positive sexual psychology. So let's talk about what that looks like. I'm working with clients who are polyamorous, ethical non-monogamy, and I would like to learn a little bit more and how is that connected, if it's connected at all with sexual abuse, because they can't say, you know, if that's even something to consider. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but that's where I'm able to consult with other people and look at what that looks like.
So what the hell is an alchemy group?
Alchemy is, when you think about science, alchemy is when you take a basic material and convert it into gold. It was said to be, there was alchemists in Egypt. They had apothecary. It's kind of like they would make medicine, if you may. But when we talk about it in psychological terms, it's when you have an event in your life that happened that you're able to transform it into something meaningful.
I love that.
So when we talk about alchemy and in psychology, Carl Jung coined that term, and he said, you know, there are things in your life that have happened and you don't necessarily need to get stuck on that. It can be alchemical. It can lead to transformation of the soul, transmutation of soul, meaning that it can serve as a launching pad to find meaning and purpose if you allow yourself to trust the process of transmutation. And so it all happens through alchemy. Yeah.
I'm leaning into that.
Yeah.
I think I'm an alchemist. Yeah. Listeners, you tell me if you think I think that I'm an alchemist.
I think to a certain extent we all are. When we look at our trauma, when we look at our wounds as children, and when we're able to actually sit with it and look at, you know, I've had child abuse, I've had neglect, and I'm able to look at it and see I'm not going to transfer this trauma on. I'm going to transform it. Mm-hmm. Remember, trauma not transformed is trauma transferred. Mm-hmm. And so the chemical process is being able to sit with it, own it, and say, yeah, I'm not responsible for the trauma that was done to me, but I am responsible for my healing. And so part of that is seeing what is the trauma, what's the wound that has impacted me mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, relationally. And how has it impacted me? And to get stuck in relationships, stuck in my mind, stuck in addiction, stuck in unhealthy workplace. How has it got me stuck in scarcity? It's a big one, like thinking that I'm not enough. And how am I going to work through that, tending to my wounds and allowing myself to heal in the process and not stay stuck? That's alchemy. So to be able to, and it's a, there's a sense of empowerment there too.
Absolutely.
Like I'm not a victim. I am a survivor. I'm not going to allow it to have power over me. I'm going to empower myself to rise up despite of it. One of the things I'm very appreciative of is that because we are able to go through the alchemy process of transmutation of soul, it makes us better to hold space for ourselves and for others. Because I've been there, because I've done that, not to minimize your experience, I can hold space. I can sit with you as you process and work through yours. Does that make sense? I can support you. I can help you. And I can empathize with you as well. And that's what makes this fellowship piece of being able to connect through podcasts, through friendships, through, you know, meetings with other people. Maybe, you know what? I'm not alone. People have overcome this. People have risen above this. And it's inspiring and motivating to see and hear their stories, and gives me the strength to continue moving forward and not get stuck.
So I saw that you were on another podcast, and the title of the episode was "The Medicine is in the Wound."
Yes.
Do you want to expand on that?
Yes, definitely. You did your homework.
Yeah, I'm a stalker. I'm a mild stalker. Proud of it. So
the concept of the medicine that is in the wound came from the analogy of penicillin. Penicillin medicine came from bacteria. After a certain time of the bacteria starts growing and starts transmuting, starts evolving. Think about penicillin. It's one of the strongest medicines that we use, and it came from bacteria. And so when we look at the medicine is in the wound, we don't have to look outside for our medicine. We have to look inside our wounds, tend to that. And we will get our penicillin. We will get our medicine when we lean into it, when we tend to it, when we hold space for ourselves through meditation, through prayer, through art, through music, whatever your spiritual practice is to tend, you will find medicine and healing when you sit with that part of yourself. What we tend to do is we're always looking outside of ourselves. Let me find the best doctor, the best chiropractor, the best, you know, therapist. This is okay. How about you sit with yourself and you tend to yourself? And you realize in doing so, not only do you honor your wounds, but you also give space for healing. And you don't get distracted by the masses. You don't get distracted. You're able to sit and just be, not do.
Love. Yeah. Okay. Tons of other questions, but let's talk about you, sir. Did you have an adult child bottom?
Yes.
Let's hear it. Was,
yes. So a little bit of my background. I grew up in a religious home. My parents are Pentecostal Christians. And
where'd you grow up?
In Southern California. Southern California, Redlands. And so my parents, and mind you, this, and I say this so that people can understand, when I speak about my parents, I'm speaking from a place of healing now, healed place, not
yes,
hurt.
People know. Yes.
So one of the things I want to reiterate, so my parents were very religious, very dogmatic, where when they found out that I identified as gay, they totally rejected me. They totally despised me. I was not welcomed in the circle of the family because...
What age was that you came out?
When I officially came out was, and I turned in my keys because I was a church. I was a pastor, a youth pastor and a pastor of a church. So I officially came out the first time around 11 and 12, and that was not accepted.
What was that experience? When did you start to feel that way? And then who did you tell?
I was in sixth grade. I started really liking another kid that was sat next to my desk. I really enjoyed.
I thought you were going to say like a juvenile detention officer.
No, another kid. I was a kid. You know, your first love you saw. And I remember I came home and I had mentioned that I really enjoyed this person's company. And what do you mean? Well, I enjoyed spending time with them. I enjoyed interacting. And I said something to the effect of, I feel like I like them the way you like mom. Mm. And that was a big no-no. I was not accepted. So my track became very focused. Who am I hanging with? What am I doing? Where am I going? So we became like the Jackson 5 family, where we would play music. I would have to play the guitar, my brother played bass, my other brother played the drums, my sister would sing, my dad would play the guitar. So we were constantly in band, constantly practice, because we need to focus. I was not allowed to do a lot of extracurricular activities outside in the community. It was always around church. So church was the drug. Church reputation was huge, where what people think, what people said is what we follow. You don't cry, you don't feel, you don't speak, you don't say what you feel, you put that away. You have to please other people, do as other people say, because we're open letters to the community. So it was very oppressive, very, very oppressive. We couldn't listen to music, we couldn't dance, no secular music.
What kind of music were you singing?
Christian gospel music, Christian C.C. Winans, like we were Switchfoot. We were what was the, gosh, Newsboy.
Are those band names?
Yeah, band names, okay. In the 90s. It was early 90s, late 90s, early 90s, late 90s, mid 90s. So it was very oppressive. And so finally, when I graduated high school, I wanted to go to San Francisco, the Art Academy of San Francisco, and my dad and
no, you wanted to go to the Castro. Let's be honest.
Exactly. They said no. They got me a free ride to seminary in Dallas, Texas, and so I went to seminary. I was there for 2 years. Super oppressive, but I wanted to prove to my parents that I decided to get into the closet and really prove to them that I can be without being like them. I can exist and I can be worthy without being like them. But within their household, I submitted to a lot of the dogma and the rules in the household. No music, no dating, no. I mean, it was super, super, super strict. My sister couldn't have short hair. I couldn't wear shorts. I mean, it was, I mean, if have you ever heard of the Pentecostal church? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, were you guys like speaking in tongues?
Yep. Yep. That's it. Prayer, speaking in tongues, vigils, going to church about 4 or 5 times a week.
How many were there? How large was the church? Like, were there a lot of other families?
200 members. Okay. I had a very strong youth group, a very solid youth group. I became a youth leader at a very young age, which I would help coordinate car washes, bake sales for camps and whatnot. Then when I went to seminary, I was there for 2 years, and there was rumors about me being gay, but they really couldn't confirm it. I wasn't going to be able to graduate.
Were you doing stuff behind the scenes? Or
actually, no, I was just being myself.
I was just being gay.
The thing was that I started rebelling and buying, of course, Madonna CDs. Madonna, Cindy Lauper. And in my dorm room, I was hearing a lot of secular music in a Pentecostal seminary. And so it was, you know, there was rumors going around, even though I was not acting out. And so there was concerns about me being a bad reputation for the organization. And when I graduated, I came back to Southern California. And then when I came back to Southern California, they made me the youth leader for Southern California and Arizona.
Was this just like a general like seminary, or was it like Pentecostal focused?
Pentecostal focused. It was this Hispanic Institute of Ministry, which was focused on Pentecostal Spanish speaking community.
You got any weird good stories from your time there?
I think, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of, so even though we consider ourselves Latinos, we're very different in regards to our culture. We had people from Panama, people from Cuba, people from Nicaragua, Honduras, I'm Mexican. And so even though they bunched us all together, the conflict that arose was because of a clash of cultures. Mm. It was a lot of clash of cultures. And language was, even though we all spoke Spanish, language had different meaning. And so people would get very offended with certain words we would say. However, I think one of the key things I really enjoyed about this school was the fact that even though we were a small segment of the school, I really enjoy the fact that even till today, a lot of people have left the organization and still stay in touch with me. Mm-hmm. They now said, we always knew you were gay. Mm-hmm. We always knew, we never judged you, but we were afraid to say anything.
Yeah. So it's like you guys have all left the cult, essentially.
Yeah. Some have went to non-denomination, some have done, but they're not connected with the organization. But I came back to California, started pastoring, and I started doing pastoring more like outreach and community fellowship, where I started attracting a lot of youth mm-hmm. from schools. I did after school programming, vacation Bible school. And so the church just grew. But then they wanted me to get married. They're like, you need to get married. And I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
Did I organize? Did you ever date women?
Oh yeah, I dated one woman, a good friend of mine, Naomi. However, she also always knew. And when I came out, she knew that I was gay, but she was super grateful that I never married her. I would have never married her, not because I don't love her. It's just that I would have never done that to her. That's too traumatizing. That's falling into the subscription. That's to the, what is it? The dysfunction, if you may. I'm not going to do that. And so she's super grateful. She's now married and super grateful that I did that. But after that, I at 22 years old, At 22 years old, I left the church, turned in my credentials, and I came to Denver because I got a scholarship at Metro State University. After I gave them my story, let them know this is who I am. I was not aware of ACA, by the way, until 2016.
Let's back up, back up. So tell me, let's talk about when you left and you turned everything in. I mean, how were you just done? Was that something that you had been wrestling with a long time? Like what did that look like?
I was done living for others.
Yeah.
I was done pleasing the church organization. I was done living under the umbrella of a reputation. Mm-hmm. Reputation, what other people think, what other people say. That's just what we do. You can't challenge this. For me to be authentic and genuine, it's for me to subscribe to the church dogma. And I just didn't do it anymore. And finally, I turned in my credentials. I turned in my church. And I said,
what was their response? Was there were they trying to coerce you into stay? Like, is it kind of like Scientology? Yeah.
No. So what happened was I was promised tuition. And paid tuition for my undergrad and for my master's. Okay. And that had been going on for 3 years, promising, and they never followed through. And when I applied for my scholarship through Kaiser Permanente with my story, I got a full ride scholarship. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'm leaving because you guys promised me for so long this and it didn't follow through. So I'm leaving. And so then that's what got me to Denver. And they couldn't find it. They knew it would be stupid for me to stay if I got a full ride. They're okay. Not going to do that for me. So.
Okay. But that's not when you came out again.
That's when I came. When I left, I came out.
Okay.
And then that stirred up a lot of chaos in the organization.
What about within your family?
Oh, that's They stopped talking to me for about, I'd say probably 9 months. I was an embarrassment. So I have my nuclear family and then I have my extended family. My extended family were part of my church and they completely rejected
me. Cut you off.
To this day, a lot of them don't talk to me anymore because I shame the family. I'm the black sheep, if you may. I humiliated and turned my back to the church and the organization. Some of them like, whatever, it is what it is. We always knew. But there's some that were they shunned me. And they're like, you're an embarrassment. You're like the curse of the family. My parents struggled with me being gay, and it took them about 9 months to come around.
That's not too long. I would think for some family, it's years and years, you know? Yeah,
not too long. They thought it was contagious.
it's not.
They thought it was contagious, that it might stick to my, you know, my nephews and my niece. And I had a little conflict there with my sister for a while because she was afraid that it was going to confuse her son, knowing that he has a gay uncle. And it's like, what? This is not like that. But again, it's because they subscribe to the old template, the dogma of the church. But then it's almost like a lot of the, going back to ACA, a lot of the patterns started showing up. Like, not good enough, not worthy.
Of course.
The lying, the manipulation. And so I stepped away from that. They did talk to me again. It was a slow reintroduction, if you may, because they were still a little afraid of what that would look like. But it happened again when I got married.
Of course.
When I got married to my husband, they stopped talking to me for about 2 months again, because even though I had been with partners previously, two partners, the fact that I married, that was a total, like, that was by far, that's the nail in the coffin. You're definitely going to hell. Because again, you know, because of the religious and their political views, it just was not acceptable.
2 months is pretty mild, though.
Yeah, a few months is mild. I think what really did help them is the fact that they kept seeing, I'm growing, I'm evolving, I'm not stuck. Mm-hmm. And something, the way my mom said it, is that God is still with him. Mm-hmm. I don't know why God is still with him, but God is still with him because he's growing, evolving, and blessed. And I can't sit back and judge what God has blessed. And so that was a turn for me. But in 2016, and so I was a probation officer for 10 years.
That's got to be interesting. Frustrating?
Yeah, frustrating. And then that's when I started working with addiction.
Did you ever struggle at all?
No. I think for me, I have a brother who's in recovery for heroin. And then I have a lot of family members who are in recovery from alcoholism.
So it's in the genes.
It's in the genes. And so for me to witness that firsthand really kept me abreast of it. However, I did see the substitute. We put the drink down and we picked up the Bible. We picked up religion. And so that was the drug for our family. That was the codependency. There was a lot of unhealthy patterns of behaviors around church. So
do you feel like you were actually able to help many people, like as a probation officer?
Do you shit shows ever feel like you're just too damn busy to eat healthy? So I used to feel this way. Every day I would wake up with the intention of eating clean, and before you know it, it's 10:30 p.m., I'm in my bed, and I'm eating smart food popcorn. That is, until I found the perfect solution. Meal kits from Sunbasket. No matter what your lifestyle is, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. Every single recipe is shit show proof, so pre-measured, pre-proportioned, easy to prepare. I most recently made the seared Alaskan halibut with mashed potatoes and herb brown butter parmesan sauce, and it was damn good. And for you shit shows out there who only know how to work a microwave, Sunbasket also has pre-made meals that are ready to eat in less than 5 minutes. No prep, no mess. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 off your first four deliveries. That is sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your very first order.
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today.
Yes. So when I was a probation officer I did it for 10 years, and then I left to become a diversion officer. I became a probation officer and I helped a lot of people, but I realized that there was a lot of intergenerational trauma with a lot of minorities, and people did not understand them. There weren't that many cultural competent. There was a lot of there's still disparity in our healthcare system. A lot of people will not take Medicaid. And so I started realizing a lot of the kids that were in drug court had intergenerational trauma. They were adult children of alcoholics, of substance abuse, dysfunctional families. There weren't resources in the community that supported the intervention was not linguistically appropriate, nor was it culturally competent to deal with a lot of their issues. And so then that's when I worked for judicial, I decided to go get my master's in counseling.
So when you became a probation officer, what was your undergrad in? What did you study?
Human services.
And when had you started to learn about the intergenerational trauma stuff?
Undergrad. I started working in undergrad and started talking about intergenerational. I read Dr. Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, An Encounter with Addictions. And that book really opened my eyes to intergenerational trauma, different levels of addiction, dysfunctional families, And then I was also introduced to Carl Jungian theory and read a lot of his papers, a lot of his books around his upbringing and how he was a pastor's kid as well, and how that his mom was into seances. She was spiritual. Dad was a pastor, and his belief in higher power. He's like, there's something about wanting to please higher power, but not knowing what's the higher power within you. And so that's when I started realizing, okay, I have psychology, Carl Jung, and my experience started really funneling me into the therapist who I am. And then I went to my master's, and that's when I really got into Jungian depth psychology. And that's when I started getting onto, through drug court, I connected a lot with addictions. And then I, through my master's program, I connected with depth psychology. So then that's where the trauma and addiction came together. It was a beautiful marriage of those two.
Mm-hmm. So your bottom.
Yeah. My bottom was 2015. I had been in a relationship, and they had broken up with me, and I had my business, all my childhood wounds, not enough, not good enough. He was the, what is it called? The trophy husband, the jock, the good looking, you know, ginger, muscular. Girls would drool over him. Guys would drool over him. He was like the trophy husband, right? And so we broke up. He broke up with me because he said that my business was growing too much. We were not compatible anymore. And it was dying. And I didn't want to let go. And so finally, when we terminated the relationship. We broke up. I spiraled. Mm-hmm. I did not know who I was. I came home. I was at a conference in Colorado Springs, symposium, and I came home. And when I came home, his furniture was, his stuff was gone, and all of our house was decorated with his art. He was huge on art. The walls were bare. And I had a good friend that was my roommate here, and I saw him, and I walked in and I saw my house. And I cannot explain, the blood pressure just fell to my feet and I collapsed. Like, this is the reality. This is the personification of everything I thought I was. Mm. I failed. I'm no good. I'm not worthy. I lost it. I'm not good enough. All of those narratives, those fears just came flowing, and I went into this deep state of grief, and I was confronted with my wounds, my childhood wounds. And I took a month off of work because I was completely, I would say, borderline catatonic. Like, I could not function. Because I was pissed at my dad, pissed at my mom, pissed at my ex. I was not suicidal, but I was like, what's the point?
That's exactly how I was too. I'm like, if this is what life is like, what's the point?
What's the point? I want to flip burgers. I don't want to do, here I am with a practice, booming practice. And then Kevin, I reached out to Kevin, and I was like, I am my good friend, Kevin Peterson. And I was like, I'm lost. I'm in this dark place, space. I'm not healthy, but I'm not sick. And it's not, you know, people were like, oh, you're acting like if you're, you know, here comes the diagnosis, right? You know, you're depressed, major depressive disorder. And I was like, no, this is not major depressive disorder. This is trauma. And I finally said it, this is a soul wound. Mm-hmm. This is a soul wound. This is a wound from my depths of my core that I have not dealt with, that it's coming and it's paralyzing me mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, relationally. I don't know who I am with myself. And I journaled. And I remember I said, I don't know how to be my own best friend, and I would not date myself. Yeah. I don't know who I am. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and I realized, and I read that again and again and again. It's like, holy shit, this is codependency at its best. I lost my sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think it was ever there?
Yes. But then I attached to the people pleasing with that ex. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I was starting to flourish and then I found that person and then I attached, like, oh, here, let me put all my meaning and purpose in you. Let me, because I did not know how to sit with, I was not fully, I was not even engaging in the process completely when I attached to somebody. And like I said, some people attach to alcohol, to drugs. I attach to that person. Mm-hmm. And I can say wholeheartedly honest and take full ownership. I became codependent of that person. Mm-hmm. Like, you make me happy. You mm-hmm. are the purpose for me working. You are, I mean, and now looking back, it's like, it's, if you look in the dictionary for codependency, my picture would have been. And it wasn't until I terminated that relationship that I realized I've lost myself, mm-hmm. but I needed to get lost to find myself. And when that happened in 15, 16, I went into ACA and I started realizing, you know, at first I went in, I was like, this is not for me. This is not for me. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't use substances. This is not for me. And then when I started reading about dysfunctional families and seeing all of the laundry list, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's me to the T. And when I started looking at the trees of the, you know, all the dysfunctional branches, procrastination, people pleasing, and just on and on, and I was like, this is me, this is me. And it's like, but I'm, and then, but there was something in my head saying, I'm not an alcoholic though, I'm not a substance. And then finally one of the members said, you know what, Alex, some people put the drink down and pick up the person. You've never had the drink, you've never had the drug, but you always had the person. Mm-hmm. You left the church and you picked up a person.
Picking up the person was even, was a lot more painful to me than mm-hmm. the drugs and the alcohol.
Yeah.
Like that, there's just, it's just the most miserable feeling in the whole world. It's mm-hmm. horrible.
And, you know, now that I've been in ACA and I've gone through my steps and you know, I'm still working my steps, and I look back, I was like, wow, I was really, talk about emotionally drunk and emotionally sober. Now that you're, I become emotionally sober working towards that, I look back and it's like, wow, I was really numb. I was really in my full blown addiction of codependency. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want to eat? What makes you happy? Where do you want to go? How, you know, it's like my world revolves around this. And now that we terminated that relationship, here we go by that terminated, broke up. I look back and it's like, wow, people even told me, it's like, oh my gosh, you were parenting, you were parenting, you were parenting. You became a parent to this person. I was like, wow, there it is. You were really not partners. You were more of a parent.
Parent. What have been some significant ahas as far as the impact that your childhood had on you, like since joining ACA?
I think for me was how subtle the messages were. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I use the analogy of downloading and installation. And the social environment gives you things that you get to download. And as we become teenagers and adults, we install them. And so I've always downloaded things like, this is what we do. You don't question this. This is how we do it. You know, machismo, toxic masculinity. I've always downloaded, installed it. And I think for me, when I started realizing, wow, I have a lot of internalized homophobia that feeds my inner child wounds of scarcity, of not being enough. Okay, when I started realizing that's like, where, how am I going to do with that now? Oh man, it's not, I can't sit here and blame my mom and dad today. I have to, again, I can't go back and change the past. I'm not responsible for my wounding, but I am responsible for my healing. So what am I going to do now, right here and now? Am I going to sit here and cross my arms and just curse my parents? Or am I going to actually do the work And what does that look like? Does it start with forgiveness, awareness, journaling, and doing an inventory of how has being attached or allowing this installation or download stay within my psyche, my system, my soul, my core? How has it contaminated me? Has it served as a mold in my relationship with other people? Am I projecting a lot? Am I being insecure? Am I gossiping? Am I, you know, what are some of the unhealthy behaviors that I'm engaging in because of my downloads, because of my installation? And that whole working the steps has really helped me do a, what is it, an internal audit, cleaning of myself and work on the healing.
Why? I don't think you're going to have an answer for this. It's kind of similar to like addiction. I don't know why some people are able to get sober and other people aren't. It almost just seems, I mean, I'm sure there's some, I don't know. I hate saying like that God's involved because I believe we all have our, you know, higher power, but like, I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know why some people have all the best resources at their fingertips and never get sober. Somebody, you know, all that stuff. And it's like the same thing with like adult child. Like, why is it that some people are able to get to a place where they're finally ready to do the work and other people aren't? You know, it just seems like it's just random, you know?
Yeah. I think in my experience, I can speak on my experience, I've learned to understand that life is full of complexities. It's always going to be complex. And there's always going to be that duality as you, it's like the onion. The more you heal, the more stuff that's going to come out. And understand that all of that is going to serve for you to become a better person. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, now that I'm at, you know, I came out at 22, I'm now 43, 20, you know, 21 years after. And I look back at everything I've gone through, all the struggles, and I realize everything had a purpose in that
moment.
Exactly. Right. Everything. I now understand why I had to have that breakup in 2015 in order to be successful where I'm at today. I know why I had to break up with that horrible first relationship that they cheated on me, because that was going to help me be who I am today. In the moment, it mm-hmm. seems like I want to give up. In the moment, it seems like a burden so heavy. In the moment, Carl Jung says, we're in the swampland of the soul. In the moment, we're in that swampland. But it's up to you if you want to give in or continue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about as far as, because like for me, you know, I hit my adult child bottom at 9 years. And that's kind of like when I started to really dig into this stuff. I think that a lot of people who can't stay sober is because they're not addressing this stuff. Mm-hmm. However, I have mixed feelings as far as when to start really diving into this stuff, because it's really heavy, you know? And so it's like countering, okay, we got to take them as they're killing it. You know, we got to get the one that's killing us first, which is the sobriety. Like, we need to get sober. And I think we need to get a solid grounding there in order to be able to start digging into this stuff. But what about if this stuff is preventing us from getting sober, yeah. You know? So what's your, like, how do you handle that?
Twofold. So coming from a depth psychological union perspective, I think.
What does depth psychology mean? Because I saw, do you have your PhD in it, or are you working on
it
now?
I'm almost done. I'm working towards it. I'm working
okay. What the hell does that mean?
Depth psychology is, so when you look at the fathers of psychology, it's Freud, mm-hmm. Carl Jung, Alfred Adler. So one of the things that differentiates Jung is the definition of psyche. For him, psyche equals soul.
Okay.
So Freud did not look like, I mean, not Freud, Jung. Jung did not focus only on psychopathology, sickness, the way Freud did.
Okay.
He only looked at psychology as a way to define sickness, pathology. Jung said, wait a minute, we can also look at psychology as both. As to define hurt and wounds, but also to define empower, strength from psyche, from soul. So when we talk about depth psychology, it's not only looking at it from an ego perspective, but also looking at it from a soulful perspective. something that almost like the internal light concept, flame, fire, that either is shut off, depressed, neurosis, upset, trauma, or is lit, which gives you the inspiration, motivation to keep moving forward. And in life, there's going to be events, according to depth psychology, like depression. When depression shows up, depth psychology says, what is depression asking of you and from you? Does that make sense? So it does, you don't look at it as pathology. You look at it as it's a way
purposeful.
Purposeful. Soul is showing up through means of depression to ask you to change something within you. Does that make sense? So it's very soulful. And so when we talk about psychology, according to Jung, psychology is this research of psyche. Psychiatrist is medication of the psyche. Psychotherapy is tending to soul. So when we do psychotherapy from a depth psychological point, you tend to your soul. You tend to your wounds. You tend to the damage that's done to you. So that's a depth psychological term. So that's what where we come. So when we talk about from a depth psychology, we use the Greek definition of psyche, which is soul. So we're going to do some soul tending, soul work. So then that being said, when we talk about trauma, we're going to use the Greek definition of trauma, which is wounds. So let's look at the soul wounds that you've had throughout your life and impacted your perspective, impacted how you see the world, your glasses. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it gives the client a sense of empowerment instead of pathology. I'm sick. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? And mm-hmm. so that's depth psychology. For me, what's really has helped, or what's really helped formulate through a depth psychological point, is understanding that everything that I've gone through in my life has served a purpose to be for my individuation, for my self-actualization. I had to go through everything to be who I am today, to be able to sit with you, to share this podcast with other people. So I was able to achieve medicine by tending to my wounds, as you are, as anyone is able to. Anybody can do this.
Mm-hmm. So what about, to circle back to the addiction, like when to address this stuff when it comes to addiction?
I think when it comes to addiction is, are you, I go back, what would heroin say to you right now? What would alcohol say? If we can give a microphone to alcohol, what would it say? You can't live without me. You depend on me. You need me to numb you. You need me to survive. You need me to function. So we personify from a depth psychological point. What is the alcohol? What is the substance? What is the addiction asking of you, from you, by you? Mm-hmm. Are you, you know, you need me in order to survive, to not feel, to numb. Okay, so what is that saying about you? You're wounded, you're hurt. Are you willing to take away the substance that's numbing? Are you willing to tend to that? And do you have the ego strength to admit it, to address it? You know how we can say, walk it off, walk it off, walk it off. And you know, when you hurt yourself, just walk it off, you'll be fine. We tend to do that. Just walk it off. We'll just forget about it. Just sweep it
under. Yeah, you walk yourself off a damn cliff.
And then you start realizing the addiction has gotten worse, 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 because you don't have the ego strength to do it. And so a lot of people, when we look at why do people continue going back to old patterns, because it's a lot of work.
Exactly.
And I'm not ready. It's too painful, it's too hurtful, or I don't have this system to support me during my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crucial. Yeah, I saw one of your other videos, you were talking about sacrifice.
Yeah.
About with healing and transformation. Do you want to touch upon that?
Yeah, so part of that sacrifice has to do with, am I willing to sacrifice ego? Like, for example, I've always been transparent. I've always, you know, a lot of my people know who I am and what's my story. And so am I willing to sacrifice face to show up authentically?
Mm-hmm.
Am I willing to be vulnerable and allow, give room, for example, when I talk about my woundings, my rejection, am I willing to allow myself, give myself permission to be vulnerable and shed a tear or two because of my wounding and allow myself to be in that space? Or am I too worried about, people are going to judge me, criticize me, I'm going to be seen as weak? Because that interferes with the healing process. That interferes with the process of flow, letting this out, processing. And so when we look at, can I honor that space within me? Mm-hmm. A lot of people struggle with that because they don't have the ego strength, or they don't give themselves permission to be open and vulnerable to allow that healing to come through.
Yeah, I think another thing too that's important, or what I'd like to ask you about, is just dealing with the resistance that comes up as we're on our healing journey. I mean, the fact of the matter is, like, this isn't going to just be like a steady climb up, and you know, we might start to feel better, but then, you know, we kind of hit low points, and how to understand that that doesn't mean that we're not changing, right? Like, the resistance and the pain is all part of the process.
Right. Right. It's all part of the process, and it's part of the healing. I always say hurt is part of healing. Think about surgery. Mm-hmm. When I go through surgery, we get painkillers to not feel pain. But if it's hurting, that lets you know it's part of the healing. Mm-hmm. Hurt is part of the healing. So think about it. When you get, I remember when I got appendicitis, and they gave me pain medications, and they said, it's not going to take care of all the pain. You're still going to feel some hurt. But that lets you know that the hurt that you feel is going to let you know that you're healing. And we have to understand that that is our natural way of our body, our psyche, our spirit, our soul, letting us know we're healing. When we allow the pain to come through the flow, when you break your arm, I'm hurting, I can't sleep, it hurts so much, right? Pain is part of the healing. Hurt is part of the healing. We can't heal without honoring it.
Exactly. Can we talk? I want to talk a little bit about just like various healing modalities. So, you know, I know that with EMDR, obviously, the research shows that it's most effective when you're dealing with kind of a big T trauma that's more recent. I want to get your thoughts on using that for complex trauma and childhood trauma. And, you know, my understanding is that in order for it to be effective, you really have to take some more time in those preparatory phases before you actually like get into like doing the damn thing.
Right. Correct. And so when I go back to that ego strength, mm-hmm. Part of EMDR, the protocol is the person stable? Is the person able to allow the flow of hurt and pain and have dual awareness? Mm-hmm. Can they be aware of the pain and stay present in the moment? Mm-hmm. Can they be aware of the pain and not disassociate and not check out? Mm-hmm. And they be in the pain and allow themselves to get outside or in the edge of that window of tolerance as they allow this processing to go through. Mm-hmm. If they can't, that means that we have to solidify ground, do more grounding, do more container, more sort of space, so that they can feel comfortable within their psyche, within their body, within themselves to get to that point. It takes time. It's not like, you know, when people say, I'm able to do EMDR in 12 sessions and we're done. No, there's people who take time. It could take 6 months. I work with survivors of sex trafficking, and they've taken 2 years to get to a point where they can start with the process because they need to feel comfortable in their skin, within their psyche, to be able to process a lot of their trauma. And part of that's going to take time, building rapport, trusting themselves as well.
So do you think, like, I know you do like CBT stuff. What about DBT? Like, how is that beneficial for trauma?
Complex trauma? I think that the dialectic, so when we talk about DBT, it's dialectical behavioral therapy, having that awareness, the dual awareness. This is my rational mind. This is my emotional mind. And then there's the wise mind. When I'm able to balance my rational and my emotional mind and not be irrational, impulsive, or emotional, reactive. Does that make sense? Because what tends to happen is when I am not coming from a wise mind, a balanced mind, centered mind, I tend to overanalyze. And because I overanalyze, I create narratives that are not true. And because I overanalyze, I overwhelm. And because I'm overwhelming, I overanalyze. Because I overanalyze, I'm overwhelmed. And so I'm reactive, 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 reactive. Because I'm not coming from a why space. So then that lets the client know, okay, I can take a step back and I can see, okay, what is the thought that's coming up for me? What's the emotion? Those are two different things that are influencing each other. What's the wise thing to do right now? Not make a decision, not say that statement, not, you know, not react to a text, not, you know, lash out. Okay, why? Because I'm coming from an irrational place, or I'm coming from an emotional space. So what do you need right now to de-escalate and be able to be wise in what you say? Intentional. Working on the four pillars of emotional regulation, interpersonal relationships, mindfulness, and distress tolerance.
Obviously, we're all unique and we all have our own healing journey.
Right.
How, and there's many modalities, how does one know if this whatever modality they're using is not a good fit for them, or if it's resistance at play trying to get them to just stop healing?
I think it's very, number one, be honest with yourself. I've had several situations where I had just about earlier this year, I was working with this one specific individual that we started doing work around her trauma, her trauma around her dad. And I started noticing that every time she'd come in, she would ask me, are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? And I was like, no, but this is concerning. What's the narrative? And she started saying, I'm starting to realize that I'm worried that you're going to be mad at me because of X, Y, and Z. And I said, you know what? Now you're projecting your childhood trauma onto me. So is this going to work? Or do you need to find a therapist who's not a male? And she's like, I don't know. Let me think about it. The following week, she came back. She goes, no, I do need a new therapist. Why? Because I'm projecting. I'm now seeing you and treating you as my dad. And I'm asking you every time I come in, are you mad at me? And it wasn't until you said it that I realized it. So I think being honest with yourself and realizing, is this working for me? If it's not, say it's not working for me. And tell the therapist, you are the consumer. You are the customer. It's like, you know what? This isn't what happens if something's not cooked the way you want it. You send it back. It's the same way. It's like, hey, something's not working for me. Can we explore different options? Or do you have a referral that I can go with someone? I'm not a good fit for everybody. I know that 100%. But then I also know that people don't know that I'm not a good fit for them. And I can tell, hey, I don't think this is a good fit for you and I. How about we explore these other options? Here's why. I'm not rejecting you. It's because you need a little bit more of this, of this, of this. And I can't offer you that. So it would be a disservice to continue seeing you. But I think that honesty within yourself and advocacy for yourself to say, this is not working. It's not going to offend. I mean, you're paying for it. You're a consumer. You have the right to that.
So I want to kind of close with, that's not my chicken. But first, can you tell, so you just did this TEDx talk.
Right.
And in the beginning, I needed more information. So I need more. So somebody was impersonating you.
Yes.
Please share.
Yes.
So this is when you were a probation officer, or you were doing diversion?
No, this was when I was a full-blown probation officer. If you guys, anybody can Google this, Denver juvenile probation officer impersonated. You'll see the whole Denver Post, the picture of the person who did it. So I was a probation officer, and this city employee impersonated me to groom a 15-year-old child.
So were you working with youth?
I was in drug court. I was working in drug court, and a city employee impersonated me to get to a 15-year-old boy.
How did they do it? Like, they went to their house, or what were they doing?
In Denver, the probation building is catty corner to the city and county building. And so he would park outside and look at who was coming out of the building. And so that's how we picked him. And so he groomed him, showed him his badge, and let him know, your probation officer referred me to you. I'm your social worker. And that's how he introduced himself as his social worker. And then he eventually took him out on the weekends. You know, the whole article explains everything. And when mom would pick up, when he would come home late, he would say that he was with me. And so when mom called, he picked up the phone and said, he identified himself as me. saying, this is Alex Castro, your son's probation officer. He's with me and I'll take him home whenever I'm ready.
So initially were you getting, they thought it was you?
They thought it was me. And so it happened on the weekend. So it was like a Friday afternoon. So Friday to Monday, I received at least 35, 40 phone calls, curse words, insults in Spanish, of them calling me, you know, they're going to go to the newspapers, they're going to go back to, you know, investigators, you know, to different TV channels, the special investigators. And then when I came in the office, that's when I heard all the messages and it's like, wait, what? This can't be. And then that's when the whole investigation started.
But how long was it until they figured out who it was?
It was very, the kid that, like 2 days, 3 days, the kid was they interviewed and they found out who it was right away. Within 2 days.
Yeah. Do you know what were they charged with?
I believe it's contributing to a delinquency of a minor. It's all in the news article. Contributing to an impersonation of a law enforcement, because I'm probably in the state of Colorado, we're considered law enforcement. Impersonation of law enforcement. I think he got hit with sex offender. Wow. So there's a whole bunch of, there's like four or five charges that he got hit with. Yeah.
When was that?
2008, 2009.
Wow, that was a long time ago. Okay, so tell the That's Not My Chicken story.
So Not My Chicken is a coping mechanism that came out of working with somebody near and dear to my heart. They were working at a local grocery store and they were in charge of the deli. And so they had a fried chicken. And so this elderly couple would always come into the deli and ask for a piece of ham, chicken, a piece of potato, and he would give it to them. But the chicken would be burning. And after 3-4 visits, he lost it, cursed at them. They reported him. He had to go take some classes as a result of his temper. And when working with him, I talked to him about, you know, what, you know, did you lose your job because of the chicken burning? No. Did they cut your hours? No. Did they change from departments? No. So why are you getting mad, upset over chicken that doesn't belong to you? It's not your chicken. Don't take ownership of something that doesn't belong to you. You have a responsibility, but it's not yours to take on. And so Not My Chicken is a way of reminding yourself when you are dysregulated mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, when you're stuck or not able to function, you're taking on something that doesn't belong to you. It's not my chicken. And so I've used this a lot with professionals, doctors, nurses, counselors, people that I've trained, law enforcement agencies, as a way of coping mechanism when you're going home. And as you're going home, I'm upset, I'm angry, I'm dysregulated. You have to ask yourself, what am I taking home that doesn't belong to me? Is this my chicken? No, it's not my chicken. So when you leave work and you feel like you're dysregulated, you're discombobulated, you feel like mentally, emotionally, you're not able to function, one of the coping skills that I always tell people to use is do a chicken check-in. You know, is it mentally? Is it emotionally? Is it physically? What is it that I'm feeling dysregulated in? Oh, you know what? It's about my thoughts. Okay, what are you taking on that doesn't belong to you? Oh, the fight that my employer had with my coworker. Okay, is that yours? No, then leave it alone. Let it go. So it's a way of setting boundaries, healthy boundaries within yourself and others.
Well, I'm glad that's not my cheese, because like every cheese is my cheese. So
yeah, and so I got a TED Talk and TEDx Talk, and it just blew up, and people see me as like, hey, you're the chicken guy.
T-shirts.
Yes.
We need merch. If you don't do it, I'm going to steal it. So
yeah, my chicken. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So
I'll give you a cut. Okay.
Yeah. It's become a thing of Not My Chicken. People have been using it a lot. And so, I mean, it's an honor to have people say it, but it's a huge coping mechanism around boundaries and self-care.
I love it.
Definitely.
So when Kevin mentioned, he was like, oh, he's going over to Europe to do shit. What are you doing over there?
So I go to the Zurich Institute, the Union Institute. Every 2 years, they have intensives. And so I get different techniques from a depth psychological school on how to come back and work with trauma, with adolescence and addiction, and how to apply those concepts from a soulful perspective. So I go every 2 years to Europe, to Zurich, Switzerland, to get that training. And then I go facilitate, I get invited to go do trainings and conferences all over based on my modalities and the treatment that I do. So yeah.
Love that. So is there any like new research that's come out lately that's kind of interesting at all to what we talk about on this podcast?
I think if anything, there's going to be, I think there's starting to come out a lot of, I don't know if you've noticed that there's this rise of soulfulness mm-hmm. that's coming up with psychology. So I would say keep your eyes and ears open because they're starting to incorporate a lot of spirituality with psychology. And as it shows up in body, as it shows up in dream, I do a lot of dream work with people around trauma. What is the theme? Let's do animation. And that's a whole nother conversation of how are your dreams speaking to you about your wounds, about your lack of work or your progress in life. And so we're starting to realize this huge shift in paradigm. Yes, about research still there, but a strong component of spirituality when it comes to healing.
Well, this has been amazing. We're definitely going to have you back.
Thank you.
What do you want to push? What do you want to promote? Where do you want to be found? Do you want to be found?
Yes. Yeah. So if people want to look for me, they can look for me at either at liferecoverycenters.net on my website or Transcending Consulting Group. If they want to, like I said, I do a lot of training, a lot of consulting in the community. You can look at my transcendingconsultinggroup.com. Or they can look at Life Recovery Centers. That's my outpatient trauma and addiction center as well.
Do you do any virtual work or no?
Yeah, I do virtual work as well. Yeah,
okay.
I do virtual.
But do you have to live in Colorado?
Yes, you have to live in Colorado. Unless you're doing consulting, you don't need to. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This is such a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, Chit Shows, if you were someone who constantly finds yourself giving and then giving more to the point where you are completely burnt out, listen up. I am teaming up with the Boundaries Queen herself, Barb Nangle, to host a transformative workshop called Stop Overgiving, Repair Your Life from the Inside Out. It's happening on Wednesday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and this workshop is for anyone who is trapped in people-pleasing patterns, exhausted from sacrificing your needs on behalf of others, for anyone whose inability to set boundaries is causing you to neglect yourself, saying yes when you really want to say no because you think saying no makes you a bad person. In this workshop, Barb is going to teach you how to set clear, authentic boundaries, giving you real tools you can start using immediately. She will provide you with tips and scripts on what to say and how to say it, as well as what to do when people push back against your boundaries. Plus, there will be plenty of time for you to get answers on your personal questions directly from a boundaries expert. So if you are ready to break out of this people-pleasing prison you're trapped in, start living for yourself, well, how about you head to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops to get your damn spot. I'm also running a special right now. If you join the Shit Show community between now and November 1st, you will get access to this workshop for free. So with limited capacity, make sure you get your ticket now before it's gone. So either go to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops or go to the show notes and DM the Join Shit Show. Trust me, this is a workshop you don't want to miss.